Neanderthals may have created occasional art, but Homo sapiens sapiens were compelled to create much more. But where this seems to have really mattered was with respect to having the capacity to appreciate and value scarce commodities. This overdeveloped brain wiring supercharged our interest in scarce assets and our drive to obtain them. Behaviorally, this may have amounted to making us weirdos who collected seashells, simply because we couldn't help but value their special rarity. But as we'll explore, that odd behavioral quirk may have made all the difference for our species. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, your host, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we have got a great little piece today by returning author Jesse Myers. And I actually missed this in a message from, it was Don Joaquin. Shout out for this one. I always appreciate suggestions. This was on, DM'd me on X. And as soon as I started reading it, I was like, oh man. Oh, this is going to be a great one, because it's right in line with something I've talked about a lot on this show, is the idea that money is actually the source of civilization. It's actually the most important scaling technology for how we've crossed Dunbar's number. But Jesse actually takes it one step further, or maybe not one step further, maybe one step deeper or lower in the totem pole for what it did or how it alters the competition between species. And I don't want to give away too much because this is a really great read. So we will just get into it in a minute. Really quick, the Financial Freedom Report by the Human Rights Foundation, they have been supporting the show. And I'll be doing audio versions of their Freedom Report, but they have a phenomenal newsletter keeping up with the Freedom tools, the Bitcoin tools, and all of the events and good news and bad news on the financial freedom and human rights front all around the world. If you are not subscribed to it, you need to be. Link and details are in the show notes. If you are not holding your keys, oh my God, it is 2025, people. You got to get off your ass and you got to hold your keys. And it's stupid easy. I made a really quick video. There's like a 15-second section in the middle showing you what it's like to spend from Green Wallet with Bluetooth connected to your Jade Plus. It is dumb easy. You just select it, punch in your PIN, and then you confirm that the screen on your phone and the screen on your Jade say the same thing. And if it is, and it's where you're trying to send it, you're good to go. This solves 99% of how people lose their Bitcoin. I shit you not. And you can get 10% off with code GUY. If you haven't got one yet and you're not holding your own keys, just solve that problem. And speaking of holding your own keys, Bitcoin on-chain and Lightning wallet BitKit is a fantastic one that has a simple design and UX between just savings and spending, which is how they denote it. Great onboarding wallet for people, especially if you haven't tried out Lightning. Check it out. Also, all of it available, obviously, in the show notes. All right. With that, let's get into today's read from Jesse Myers, and it's titled Once in a Species by Jesse Myers, a groundbreaking new answer to one of humanity's big mysteries and what it means about the nature and future of money. Humanity in Art. It is often said that art makes us human. This notion becomes particularly interesting when we reach back to the edges of human history. This is the Venus of Willendorf, a fertility goddess sculpture found in Austria that dates to 30,000 BP, years before present. For perspective, that makes this statue 6 times older than the pyramids, 3 times older than agriculture, and even 5,000 years older than light skin. The figurine's proportions and cultural purpose may be mystifying, but it is unmistakably human art. We also recognize the ancient figural depictions of animals on cave walls as something we might have done ourselves if we lived as hunter-gatherers. For example, these 30,000 BP drawings of Pleistocene megafauna from the Chauvet Cave in France. Stepping back further in time, we similarly recognize ourselves in cave art. We are fond of the striking simplicity and humanizing power of hands on cave walls, etched timelessly in red ochre. For example, these handprints from Maltravieso, Spain, that reach through time to proclaim, "I was here, and here I lived." In 2024, it was determined that these handprints date to 66,000 BP, making them the oldest known cave art in the world. Just one problem. Our species didn't arrive in Europe until 20,000 years after this art was made, meaning these hands belonged to Neanderthals, and yet here they are, engaged in recognizably human art. Why us? For years now, a particular mystery has nagged at me. It started from an observation included in Nick Szabo's outstanding Shelling Out. Since then, the significance of this question has snowballed in my mind. For upwards of a few million years, there were a handful of early human subspecies coexisting on our planet. In the blink of evolutionary time, now, there's just one. Why did Homo sapiens sapiens, that's us, triumph over all other early human subspecies? Recently, a team of PhDs from Oxford argued that the answer to this question is that humans are, quote, generalist specialists, suggesting that we were able to thrive everywhere and that this explains our success. Remarkably circular logic. Anthropology's cutting-edge answer provides no sensible root cause of humanity's success. By contrast, this piece will. By rendering recent discoveries in anthropology and neuroscience through the lens of a lesser-known branch of economics, this piece puts forth an interdisciplinary answer to not only the question of why did we triumph over early human subspecies, but also to the grander question of what defines our species. Improbably, the answer to these questions can be used to understand today's ongoing financial revolution, the greatest seismic shift in the history of money. Neanderthals were humans too. We are all familiar with Neanderthals. They've long been depicted with sloped foreheads and a dumb look on their face. The archetypal brutes, cavemen huddled around fires. From the beginning of our archaeological knowledge of this subspecies in 1856, we've needed an explanation for why they went extinct and we took over. In classic Victorian fashion, the obvious answer was that we were smarter, better, and more evolved. And for over a century, that has remained the prevailing view. But it doesn't line up with the archaeological evidence. In addition to engaging in art, there are other aspects of Neanderthals that were strikingly human. According to Chris Stringer, esteemed head of human origins research at London's Natural History Museum, all the conventional explanations for why we outcompeted the Neanderthals are wrong, including better tools, better weapons, proper language, art and symbolism, and better brains. In other words, the Neanderthal archaeological record does not reveal much difference between them and us. They would have lived lives much like us. They would have thought, felt, hoped, and dreamed. They may have even placed flowers on the graves of their dead. This is what artist Tom Bjorklund aims to evoke with his humanizing depictions of Neanderthals. While Neanderthals may not have had smaller brains or worse tools, as we previously assumed, there had to have been some differences that caused Homo sapiens sapiens to outcompete. After 200,000 plus years thriving in Europe, the Neanderthals were relatively quickly driven to extinction by the new arrivals from Africa. Why? The History of Shell Bead Jewelry. One thing that is quite clear from archaeological sites is that Homo sapiens sapiens collected shells and fashioned them into beads for necklaces and other jewelry. And we've been doing this for a very long time. When Szabo published Shelling Out in 2002, the oldest evidence of this behavior dated to 75,000 BP at a cave site in South Africa. In the intervening years, even older discoveries have been made. Shell beads were discovered and dated to 82,000 BP, 100,000 BP, and 120,000 BP at sites in North Africa and the Levant. In 2021, at a cave site in Morocco, 33 small seashell beads were discovered that dated to 142,000 BP. In just a couple of decades, our understanding of how long Homo sapiens sapiens have collected seashells to fashion jewelry has doubled, and it's likely that older examples will be found still. It's quite possible that this behavior began soon after our genetic divergence from other early human species, around 300,000 BP. More on this later. It's also worth noting that these archaeological discoveries continue to be interpreted in accordance with the prevailing orthodox of anthropology. The purpose and meaning of shell beads is described almost exclusively in terms of self-expression, status, and personal identity. For example, the co-author of the academic paper announcing the 142,000-year-old beads speculates, quote, "They were probably part of the way people expressed their identity with their clothing. Wearing beads has to do with meeting strangers. You don't have to signal your identity to your mother." As an aside, this seems to be a clear example of how modern academia has become increasingly siloed in its respective areas of subject matter expertise. That's particularly unfortunate with topics such as this that require interdisciplinary knowledge to make sense of complex human behavior. Indeed, there's no mention or awareness from the anthropologists of the likely economic purpose of this shell bead jewelry. Instead, the same clueless co-author ponders, quote, "It's one thing to know that people were capable of making jewelry, but then the question becomes, okay, what stimulated them to do it?" A peculiar differentiation. Before we answer the anthropologist's question, let's first introduce an important observation about this behavior. While Homo sapiens sapiens actively and prolifically collected seashells and fashioned them into beads for jewelry, Neanderthals essentially did not. When Shelling Out was written, we had not yet found any evidence of Neanderthal shell bead jewelry. Now there appears to be a single example from a coastal cave in Spain. In addition, there are sparse examples of Neanderthals and other archaic humans collecting fossils, quartz, and other curios. This suggests that, intellectually, they had the capacity to recognize the specialness of uncommon materials, and even to engage in symbolic behavior, as we've already explored with the cave art, but only on a limited basis. It's not that they were incapable artists and craftsmen, just that they seem to have had a dim interest or drive to engage in these behaviors. From the archaeological record, we can deduce that a Neanderthal walking on the seashore would very rarely collect an ornate seashell. For us Homo sapiens sapiens, that's almost unfathomable. Of course, we would pocket the shell, take it home, and show it off. We appreciate a nice shell for its beauty, but also for its special rarity, its scarcity. In a world of sticks and stones, wood and bones, it's not often you come across a perfect shell. It does nothing for us, yet we appreciate and covet such things. In this way, we are kinda weirdos. And yet, this odd quirk appears to be the notable behavioral difference between Homo sapiens sapiens and Homo sapiens neanderthalensis. Indeed, it may explain why we are here and they are not. The hidden economic purpose of shell bead jewelry. This is where familiarity with an arcane branch of economics comes in. Austrian economists like Mises, Menger, and Hayek enumerated the properties and characteristics of commodity money. This meant studying gold and silver, but also earlier monetary mediums like glass beads, cloth strips, and seashells. The Austrians observed that human societies all over the world landed on using suitable commodities as money, to transact with and to store value in for future use. They further identified the process by which a society ends up using a particular commodity as money. First, a commodity is appreciated by a small portion of the group and becomes a collectible. Then the broader society starts to recognize that some of their peers value that commodity, and suddenly that commodity takes on intersubjective value. Everyone knows that commodity is valued by some, so everyone knows it has market value, and therefore everyone begins to value it. As this process unfolds, the novel collectible begins to take on the properties of a store of value asset. Once the majority of a society values a store of value asset, it starts to be offered as a form of payment in trade. Now the humble collectible has matured into a medium of exchange asset. Finally, once this commodity is the de facto currency for all trade, everything becomes priced in terms of that commodity. It is now the unit of account, or numeraire, for that society. With this knowledge, our ancestors' creation of shell bead jewelry is easily recognizable as a form of proto-money, as authoritatively shown in Shelling Out. The process of collecting seashells and turning them into jewelry would have been time and energy intensive. The product would have been impressive and valued for its beauty, but also for the costliness of its creation. As Szabo describes, necklaces or bracelets of shell beads could then be used to transfer wealth for important life events, like injury compensation, peacemaking, tribute, inheritance, or marriage. This mental model for shell bead jewelry provides considerably more explanatory power than anthropology's economically bereft consensus that this behavior, widespread across 100,000 plus years, was simply because everyone likes to look good for strangers. While Austrian economics reveals the behavioral purpose of shell bead jewelry as proto-money and further outlines the path-dependent process by which seashells grew to become money, what's relevant for our purposes here is what sparks this process in the first place. Why do we valuable collectibles at all? For this, we turn to our final field of study: the brain science of appreciating scarcity. Recent neuroscience research has revealed a genetic difference between our subspecies and Neanderthals. In 2022, Pinson et al. Published their findings about a single amino acid change in Homo sapiens sapiens that differs from other early human subspecies, including the Neanderthals and Denisovans. The protein created from this gene, TKTL1, is involved in stimulating new neuron production in specific brain regions. In laboratory testing, the team was able to show that the mutated version shared by all modern humans, HTKTL1, caused greater neurogenesis in frontal, higher-layer, neocortical regions of the brain, as compared to the versions of the protein shared by archaic humans and apes, ATKTL1. Specifically, this muted protein amplifies neuroprogenitor creation in the outmost layers on the front half of the brain, frontal lobe supragranular layers 1, 2, and 3. When I did my undergrad studies in neuroscience 15 years ago, these areas were well known for their unusual neuronal wiring, including pyramidal neurons and related association cortices. Pyramidal neurons link and integrate information across cognitive domains, while association cortices synthesize and generalize this information into abstract thought. With this recent discovery, we have a possible explanation for where these unusual neuron arrangements for abstract thought come from: an amino acid substitution, lysine to arginine, in TKTL1, achievable through a single nucleotide point mutation in the relevant section of Homo sapiens sapiens DNA. We can also deduce when this mutation most likely occurred. Anatomically, modern humans emerged about 300,000 BP in East Africa. Humanity's most recent genetic bottleneck and matrilineal common ancestor, known as mitochondrial Eve, lived roughly 160,000 BP, likely in East Africa. Given the facts, this mutation most likely occurred sometime between 300,000 BP and 160,000 BP. What seems to have gone remarkably unappreciated by anthropology is the functional neuroscience of the affected brain regions and how the resultant behavior change could make this single amino acid mutation a defining demarcation point in human evolution. In essence, this altered protein, HTKTL1, may have played a role in overdeveloping the specific brain regions involved in abstract thought, as compared to Neanderthals and other archaic human species. Importantly, this explains how we see occasional evidence of symbolic behavior, like art and collectibles, among archaic humans. The HTKTL1 change in our early lineage greatly increased the development of our abstract thought circuitry and resulted in the creative explosion of culture seen with the global takeover of Homo sapiens sapiens. In similar terms, what this means is that modern humans are wired different. We may not have been any smarter than Neanderthals, as evidenced by similar tool sophistication and our slightly smaller brains, but we had a penchant for abstract thought. It seems likely that this single mutation drove the supercharging of symbolic behavior in our subspecies. Neanderthals may have created occasional art, but Homo sapiens sapiens were compelled to create much more. But where this seems to have really mattered was with respect to having the capacity to appreciate and value scarce commodities. This overdeveloped brain wiring supercharged our interest in scarce assets and our drive to obtain them. Behaviorally, this may have amounted to making us weirdos who collected seashells simply because we couldn't help but value their special rarity. But as we'll explore, that odd behavioral quirk may have made all the difference for our species. The foundational building block of human flourishing. The other clear disparity between early modern human cave sites and Neanderthal cave sites in Europe is the population density. When Homo sapiens sapiens took over an area from Neanderthals, they were somehow able to support 10 times the population on the same territory versus the prior Neanderthal inhabitants. This has long been considered a curious fact without a tidy explanation, but the explanation has been right under the nose of the anthropologists: shell money. The widespread presence of shells at Homo sapiens sapiens cave sites suggests that we had already developed the concept of money by the time we arrived in Europe around 45,000 BP, and this innovation allowed for much larger social groups. In 1992, Robin Dunbar published, quote, "Neocortex size as a constraint on group size in primates," concluding that humans have the capacity to maintain stable social relationships with about 150 individuals, now famously known as Dunbar's number. A year later, he published a follow-up paper that added language and social gossip as an efficiency multiplier that allows humans to manage bonds in 150-person tribes without having to spend almost half the day engaged in one-on-one socializing. But this still doesn't account for how humans do manage to live in populations much larger than 150. An additional efficiency multiplier neatly resolves this conundrum: the concept of money. In a barter system of goods and favors, a social group can only reach about 150 individuals before the number of interpersonal relationships becomes too numerous to keep track of. Note, that's 11,175 relationships based on combinatorial math. At this point, the individual ledgers of personal debts between counterparties become impossible for the rest of the group to help police. In other words, a society without money can only function if it stays limited to Dunbar's number of 150 people, a tribal existence. Note that within this moneyless paradigm, intertribal relations would be generally antagonistic, with the benefits of barter overshadowed by unending grudges and blood feuds, devoid of a mutually agreeable means of peacemaking between tribes. By contrast, if you have the concept of money, you not only are freed from the constraint of interacting chiefly within a closed group of 150, but you also gain the necessary transactional medium for constructive intertribal relations. First, with the concept of money, goods and services can flow and be paid for at the time of transaction between an infinite number of counterparties, fostering rudimentary capitalism. Money removes the need for the tribe to help police the mental ledgers of debts and favors between all counterparties, which may be the primary constraint that Dunbar's number actually captures. Second, and perhaps more importantly, with the concept of money, multiple tribal groups can coexist in close proximity. In the same way that money can be transferred between individuals within a group for important events like injury compensation, peacemaking, and tribute, it can also be transferred for the same reasons between tribal entities. Thus, money provides a transactional medium for constructive intertribal relations as a new option alongside time-honored violence. Equipped with money, tribes can more easily engage in trade, as well as negotiate and maintain mutual security alliances. In turn, these benefits naturally foster the development of super-tribal groups living in close proximity, thereby achieving 10 times the population density of other early human subspecies. The coordination of such large, multi-tribe populations would constitute a clear advantage when competing for resources against solitary tribal units of Neanderthals or any other archaic human species. Ultimately, this means that having the concept of money was the essential differentiator that allowed our subspecies to proliferate, and as we've explored, it's also the key ingredient that enabled large-scale population coordination to develop. Therefore, appreciating money is the foundational building block of human civilization, and consequently, of human flourishing. While Neanderthals and other archaic humans had the basic brain circuitry necessary for abstract thinking, as evidenced by occasional art and collectibles, this latent capacity was evidently insufficient. A certain threshold of covetous interest in scarce collectibles is necessary to bootstrap the concept of money in a social group. Neanderthals and other archaic humans lacked the brain circuitry to achieve this critical mass. And herein lies the answer to our question. The reason that Homo sapiens sapiens outcompeted all other human subspecies is that we were wired differently, and as a result, we have an exaggerated capacity to appreciate and value commodities that are hard to come by. In other words, we are wired to cherish and covet scarce collectibles, like seashells. This charming quirk is actually the basis for our overpowering evolutionary advantage, as it enabled our species to bootstrap the concept of money. In turn, this unlocked capitalism and enabled the large-scale coordination of interests that we call civilization. It turns out that it's not art that makes us human. Instead, our fascination with scarce assets is what makes us human. Fulfilling a species-long quest. Whereas modern anthropology has offered up circular logic as an answer to this question, one of humanity's great mysteries, we have now laid out a cogent and complete alternative. Humanity's triumph is likely due to a single amino acid mutation between 300,000 and 160,000 BP, supercharging our brain centers for abstract thought, allowing for the critical mass of interest necessary to develop the concept of money, and leading to our overpowering competitive advantage of multi-tribe population coordination, unbounded by Dunbar's number. At this point, we've been entirely focused on humanity's distant past and our defining behavioral advantage over other early human subspecies. But now we would be remiss not to take these lessons of the past and apply them to understand a phenomenon of the present. Inevitably, we turn now to Bitcoin. The history of money in human civilization is characterized by an ongoing process of upgrading from one form of money to a fitter, more scarce form of money. This selective pressure of monetary Darwinism stretches back at least 142,000 years, and likely much further in our 300,000-year history. With gold's emergence as a viable store of value asset in the Danube Valley about 6,000 BP, because of the Varna culture's advances in metallurgy, the modern history of money has been characterized by the conquest of gold over all other monetary local optimums around the world, specifically because of its unmatched physical scarcity. But with the dawn of the digital age, it became possible to create a commodity more scarce than gold. Bitcoin was deliberately designed to solve for gold's weaknesses, for example, the challenges of assaying, transporting, and securely storing a physical asset, and to improve on gold's strengths. Most importantly, Bitcoin perfected scarcity. For the first time in human history, there is a form of money with immutably finite supply, the invention or discovery of absolute scarcity. If you put Bitcoin in the long timeline of human history, it is the perfection of our species' defining fascination, scarce assets. Just 16 years into its existence, we are witnessing the ongoing and inescapable gravitation of all Homo sapiens sapiens to this perfection of store of value scarcity. We can't help it. It's quite literally in our DNA to appreciate and value scarcity. With this context, it's no wonder that people who learn about Bitcoin become insufferably zealous about it. This is what we've been searching for over 142,000 years. Valuing scarcity is what differentiates us as a species, what makes us human, which means that absolute scarcity is the ultimate fulfillment of our species-long quest for better scarcity. After about 12,000 generations of mankind, somehow, we are lucky enough to be alive during this monetary transition to perfect scarcity. This only happens once in a species. All right, I hope you guys enjoyed that one. That was, again, Jesse Myers. That was Croesus, who did... Other great piece that I really love by Croesus is Why the Yuppie Elite Dismiss Bitcoin. A really good one to dig into if you haven't. In fact, if I haven't rebooted that one already, that one's actually a really good one to reboot. If I need an episode here in the next like couple of weeks while I'm working and we're still trying to get into a much better flow with the new baby and everything. But we're still having rough days, and I still have a lot to do on the audiobook because I need to finish up Bushido of Bitcoin. I really want to get that out to you guys. So if I need another reboot, we're actually going to bring Why the Yuppie Elite Dismiss Bitcoin back, because that's just a good one. But what I love about this one in particular is that it takes a... Because this is something that if you listen to the show for any length of time, you've heard this argument before. You've heard this framed from a couple of different perspectives, and it's something that I like to talk about a lot, is that what we needed. We like, abstraction is what defined the human species and what allows us to scale. And it's so much of what we think of as civilization, as flourishing, as even things that we look down on are literally just things that allow us to scale society. That the whole problem is how to scale relationships among the same species. Money is ultimately a tool of mass cooperation. And I talk about these various scaling technologies is what I think this is what how we think we should be thinking about them when it comes to the history of humanity, is money, language, religion, tradition, all of these things. These things are scaling technologies of human networks, because they allow us common ground and ways to communicate with people who are not in our social group, not in our social circle, and within our Dunbar's number. So essentially complete strangers that we can feel we have some shared value or some shared sense of reality with. And this is also why the world is breaking down. This is why there is so much division and aggressive competition, and it's essentially violence, both in the just in the general anger at each other sense, but then obviously in the literal sense of violence toward each other when it comes to political divisions and different stories we tell ourselves about the world, because of our communication networks. Our communication networks have completely and fundamentally changed how we organize and how we develop worldviews. And it has led to massive bifurcation in essentially realities. Realities. People literally create their own realities. And there is an astronomical bifurcation. And I believe that is because of the access to new information and, importantly, the access to the faults, the essentially the humanity of systems that we have held as kind of godlike. Is a great example that I think just is a perfect allegory for how the political system has gone, how people think of government, and things have just kind of come, a lot has crashed back down to earth, in a sense, is what's happened to Hollywood. And we actually saw this exact same thing in kind of a different context when you first saw, quote-unquote, talkies. You saw movies that, when we shifted from silent to movies that had sound and where you could hear the actors and actresses, and people who were famous in the silent movie industry or in the silent movie era were no longer famous in the era where you could hear them speak, because the acting wasn't the same, the association wasn't the same. It's kind of like when you see somebody that you've heard on the radio. I'm sure a lot of people have heard me for a really long time, and then they see me and they're like, oh, that is not anything at all like what I thought Guy would look like. That same sort of sensation, or that same like realization, because you start imagining something in your head, or you build this quote unquote character for them that actually isn't complete. And then you see the rest of them, or you hear the rest of them. A lot of huge silent movie actors and actresses just died, just completely dwindled out in the era of talkies. Because some of them, just nobody wanted to hear them speak. Their voice was super abrasive, or they just had like an odd tonality that just rubbed people the wrong way. Or suddenly, and this I think is really the big thing that is compared to Hollywood today, there was this sense of inauthenticity, because now you know, it's one thing to be able to act just physically or perform in such a way that's really entertaining, but when you add in a layer where you have voice and you can hear the tone and like how they are speaking words, there's a new layer of emotion that reveals how aligned you are with the story you're telling or the character you're playing. And you might not be good at that just because you were good at the former. And I think that's happened with Hollywood, because we've taken away the bright lights. We've taken away that we only see them when they're on the red carpet. And now we see their tweets and their Instagrams and Britney Spears in her crazy late night, like, you know, sticking a knife in the camera, like, what are you doing? Like, the realism of who they are and them sharing their opinions when it used to be, like, very controlled and they're only in the camera, in front of the camera at these certain times, and it's very, like, explicit what they can and can't say. Hey, buddy, you want to go outside? Okay. Well, I'm gonna pause here and come back to that, but I wanted to finish that point that the new communication medium that opened up a new realm where you could just be connected to somebody's personality. You could hear what they're thinking in the middle of the day, or their shower thoughts, or their crap thoughts. You begin to know or kind of experience this collective humanity at a different level, and people who were, where that side of them was hidden before, you can easily put up on a pedestal. Politicians can easily be seen as these godlike figures who know everything, but when they start tweeting, oh wow, they're really just dumb idiots like the rest of us. They have no idea what they're talking about. They're just like totally and unbelievably biased. They say stupid crap all of the time. Same with Hollywood actors. Oh man, that guy's just brilliant. And you only ever see them when he's, you know, acting out written lines that were run over by dozens of people and reconsidered, and super thought-provoking writers put in their input and put it in the context of some broader narrative, and it always just lands perfectly. Oh my God, he's a god. He's a god among men. She's an angel. But then you hear them tweet. Then you get like random interviews where they're talking for like an hour and a half on a podcast, and they can't be scripted, and it's like, this guy's kind of a moron. And I think that that has led to a couple of generations now that crave this authenticity, because they've just been exposed to the fact of how much has literally been scripted, how much has just been kind of put in front of our face, and it just feels like bullshit. I mean, I can't even handle the news anymore. Like, I can't listen to them talk the way that they talk. I hate it. And I think this is happening at a mass scale. This is happening the world over. And because of that, different networks are sinking back into tribalism. And I actually do not think this is a bad thing. I think this is necessary to deal with the technological transition, is that we are separating out into very, very different tribes and building completely fresh models for how we view our realities. And suddenly we're having a lot more in common with the networks we hang out with on this social media, or the people that we have this hobby with. I feel way more connection to somebody who identifies as a Bitcoiner and can easily talk to them about so many different topics. And we have this common ground and these common values where you just kind of know some of the things. There's an assumption of kind of how they see the world and the problems in it and what those solutions are. And we can have arguments and debates about all sorts of stuff, but we're still Bitcoiners. I feel more camaraderie with Bitcoiners than I do with people who are in my hometown. That's kind of crazy. I don't think that can be discounted. That's a very, very powerful force. And I think the world is going through an identity crisis. You know, if you ever have an idea that really shakes you, I imagine everybody who's listening to this has had this happen before, where something just completely messed with their worldview and made them rethink everything that they thought about how stuff works, about what was the truth, about who to listen to and who to trust. And when you're dealing, there is nothing less comfortable. It is so painful and infuriating to go through that process. And you start arguing with yourself, or at least in my experience, I start arguing with myself, and I hate, there's this feeling of like, I want to avoid this part of the conversation or this topic as aggressively as I can. It's so, the tendency or that feeling to run away from it is incredibly potent. And at some point I realized, or forced myself to recognize, that in that feeling is actually where progress exists. It's there that, you know, fear of something is almost universally because of not knowing. It's the fact that I do not know what the risk of this is, what I am up against, the size, like darkness is such a perfect example or a perfect analogy, and something that is explicitly scary, is just the great unknown. What is out there? And a lack of knowledge is darkness in what we face in the world. And when you're afraid of an idea, or you're afraid of a topic, or you can't defend yourself in a debate, or against some contradiction that people are pointing out, and you start getting that anger building up, and you're like, how do I dodge? How do I just... It's like, no, you just don't know what you're talking about, and you should listen to the experts, or whatever it is. Recognize that that is you trying to avoid something that is kind of etching away at your worldview, that's like kind of showing cracks or contradictions in how you think about things, and you should go after it. And at some point, I started to force myself to go after those ideas that made me uncomfortable. One of them that I remember kind of starkly, because I don't remember who I was having this conversation with, which is sad, because it would be cool to be like, hey, you actually made me go down this rabbit hole and consider that I was thinking very differently about things, or incorrectly about things, is my views on violence have changed as a libertarian. And one of the things that changed very specifically, because it was such a glaring contradiction, is with animals. How do you justify, or how do you make a case for animal cruelty and these things when you are also, yeah, you're allowed to shoot the animal to eat them? That was a really uncomfortable reality. And it's an interesting question, because you really kind of have to deal with nature, and so many of human ideas, like ideologies and things, do everything, especially in the modern world, because we get our beef from a grocery store, and we get our, like, everything just exists at the grocery store, and we can pretend that, oh, now I'm eating corn, so this is animal harm free. It's like, well, no, it's not. Literally nothing is. You can be 100% vegan, and that does not matter. Thousands of animals had to die to keep you alive. And this is something that it's actually bad that we are disconnected from, because I think it hollows out. It just makes so many things. We think that there are no costs to our existence. And so it doesn't matter if we waste it. It doesn't matter whatever decisions I make. I can just go out and I can just drink and have fun. I think it just adds to the high time preference and the frivolity of life and the embracing of vice to not recognize that something has to, a living animal that you could love, that had a life, had to die in order to keep you alive. And what that means for values, and what it means for morality, and where we are, where we stand in kind of the nature of the world and the natural order of things. Now, that's a bit of a tangent, but I bring all of this up because all of these things are scaling technologies. And I have thought and talked about on this show a lot that money is the source of civilization. Money is why we are able to cooperate at the level that we can. It is one of the most potent scaling technologies for scaling human cooperation. And all you have to do is just simple deductive reasoning of thinking about all of the people who you do not know, who probably believe a completely different religion than you, who probably voted for the guy that would make you want to key, drag your keys and scratch their Tesla apart, who may literally support the Communist Party of China, and yet no matter what you bought on Amazon or anything ordered from anywhere, even stuff made in the US, there is no way. All you have to do is extrapolate 1, 2, 3, 4 steps removed, and you've touched almost everybody on Earth. Go back to iPencil. I absolutely love that piece because it illustrates just how vast and complex and interconnected the actual economic system really is. But what Jesse brought up in this piece that I had not considered was that money was actually the thing that separated us as the Homo sapiens species from other human subspecies. and that our intelligence isn't really the thing that makes us so powerful or so dominant. It's about the capacity for abstract thought, which allowed us to see and appreciate scarcity, that led to the rise of money, which ultimately leads to the rise of specialization and cooperation that could make, think about this, you know, there's a criticism made against just economics, but I think kind of the Austrian economic theory in general is that, you know, the best man for the job is always the one who does it. And there is a, I cannot remember, this is probably Hayek, for some reason I'm feeling it's Hayek, makes an example about how that is actually not true. It's about trade and specialization and what makes the most sense for any individual to do at any one time in their situation and their level of skills. And so an example would be that a doctor may, like somebody who's like a brilliant surgeon, may also be a phenomenal truck driver. But because the second best truck driver sucks at surgery, the optimum for the economic system is for the doctor, the surgeon, to be the surgeon, and an objectively worse truck driver to drive the truck. And that both of these two people are vastly better off because of that trade. So the extension of this idea or simple principle that I think could express why the Homo sapiens sapiens would necessarily have outcompeted all other human subspecies if we were the only ones that developed and or adopted money is simply that 10 stupid people all working together and doing the one thing that they are best at will obliterate one very, very smart person any day of the week. They will outproduce them. They will outfight them. All of it. The ability and capacity to work as a group in a way that can actually properly allocate the resources, the value, and the skills, where those things need to go and how to coordinate them, which is exactly what money does. It is like a, it's like a superpower. It is literally a force and time multiplier on top of each other. It is a compounding of all capacities and skills, which is just kind of crazy to think about, that this could literally be the defining thing of our species and why the other human subspecies did not survive. And it's also funny, actually, that the shell bead jewelry would not have been recognized as money by anthropologists, because especially to consider the number of different times and the time span at which the same thing has been found and the incredible breadth of the distance over which these things have been found. I mean, obviously, I've read shelling out like a bunch, but that would be the first thing that I would think of. And it's exactly why they were put on strings, is so that you could wear them on your person for protection. In fact, that was the earliest forms or use of jewelry that we know of. But it is just really funny that Jesse Myers brings this up, and why I think so much of the, you know, blame it on modern society or education system, whatever the hell, but the fact that not being a generalist, you know, even if you specialize in something, I feel like learning the ins and outs and the basics of a lot of things is such an unbelievable advantage, because you can learn patterns and relationships and ways that things work that can inform and completely change your perspective in an entirely different domain. Because all different things have, like all systems and patterns have relationships that basically do extend across every domain. Like, you might not think it, but it's very, very possible that the exact same types of relationships and systems, or an extremely similar pattern in how things relate, could exist or could be learned from how to tie a bunch of crazy knots and then actually applied to something as seemingly completely disconnected from it as software engineering. All of our different categories for things like when you go to school and you learn chemistry, and then you learn biology, and then you learn history, and then you learn economics. Like all of these things, and physics, all of these things are separate. And they're in these weird, isolated, like have walls around them domains. And then even dumber is the academia actually gets like possessive about it. And it's like, oh, the people in chemistry can't make claims or, you know, can't find discoveries in physics. That's my domain. Like the culture of academia literally makes this problem so much worse. But realize something. None of those separations exist in reality. None of them. Like there's no like border between chemistry and biology or physics. These are literally just categories that we have come up with to kind of split up that, like, all of these things kind of do a lot of similar behaviors and patterns, and all of these things over here also kind of seem similar. And they seem more similar to to themselves or to each other in their group than they do across the group. But the lines don't exist. So if you actually learn a lot about how all of these different things work, the number of things that you'll find, the number of patterns that you'll see come up over and over and over again, patterns in literally waves, in frequencies and electronics that occur in society, that occur in people, in how ideas move. And I do not think that's a coincidence or a metaphor. I literally think they are patterns in how something moves through a medium. And just like waves in a pond are an energy and a wave through the medium of water, an idea is literally an electrical pattern that gets mimicked and moves through people in a wave based on how that communication gets repeated into somebody's ear and goes through their brain. And it literally travels like a wave. The medium is just the human mind, and there are many different communication mediums in which it moves from one person's mind to another. But the number of principles and ideas that can actually be useful and apply in both areas is actually kind of crazy. Anyway, I don't know, that's just my appeal to learn a bunch of stuff about a bunch of stuff, even when you specialize in one specific thing. I think that thing is, that speciality is made so much more powerful if you learn a little bit about tons of other things, because I think it gives you the foundation to relook, to see, like, just the anthropologist is just the perfect example. If they had learned very, very small amounts of economics, they would have seen what that Shelby jewelry was. Like, that doesn't take a lot of monetary history to dig into. And what a profound set of blinders they have on, or would necessarily have, in the absence of studying a foundational thing about humans, because their category is anthropology and economics doesn't fall under that. Okay, well, which humans in history do economics not apply to? None. Money or no, economics is a reality. Economics applies to dinosaurs. If there's one tree that 10 dinosaurs all eat, and it's the only tree that they can eat, and it is the last tree that exists, it's very scarce, and it's going to be insanely costly. It might cost 9 of those dinosaurs their lives in order for one dinosaur to get food from that tree. That is supply and demand 101. It applies to anything that desires and tries to achieve something. It is the study of purposeful action. Which I guess in that case, it wouldn't be any good if they learned Keynesian economics. That is just a mess of contradictions and physics envy. Just wanting to mathematically model everything like the economic system, like society isn't an organic system, but it's a piston and an engine. And then when all their shit falls apart because they're idiots and they think that they can put something in on this side of the equation and then something else will happen on this side of the equation and humans are just like a three variable math problem and then nothing goes according to their math problem, they're just like, people are stupid, they're not following my model. Nah, dude, your model sucks. Alright, I don't even know what the hell I've been talking about in this one. I hope you guys enjoyed that episode. fantastic article. Really, really interesting. Posits some really fun theories that I have a pretty strong basis. That's a pretty great exploration of the idea. I mean, obviously very shallow and short at the same time, but I think there's good reason to believe it, especially in the context of the fact that the science of anthropology, like establishment anthropology, gives a non-answer. I mean, in the absence, when there isn't an answer, like I say, he came up with a pretty solid alternative explanation to a non-explanation. Check out the blog, the Medium page, follow, heart it. I don't think this is like Medium. I think it's, yeah, you heart this one. You don't clap it. I will have the link in the show notes. Check it out. And he has a lot of other great writing. Like I said, we have other pieces that we've done on this show that I'm a big fan of. Check them out. Don't forget to check out the HRF and their amazing Financial Freedom Report. The link to the newsletter will also be down there, as well as a discount code for your Jade Plus hardware wallet. And then, of course, your BitKit wallet. If you have not tried this out, for a on-chain and Lightning wallet. BitKit has been a favorite of mine for a long time, so check it out. And also, there are little QR codes. They're short QR codes that are hidden in many, many places in little videos, and they may or may not have 5,000 sats. Just saying, like, nobody sees these. I mean, they are hidden. It's a bit of a game. But get your BitKit and go looking for it. With that, thank you guys for listening. I'm Guy Swan, and until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. Expectations were like fine pottery. The harder you held them, the more likely they were to crack. Brandon Sanderson.